Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast and of course to SavvyDentist.com. It is great to have you here. Of course, all of us in practice ownership think a lot about teams. Of course, the topic of leadership is never too far away. But of course, when you look at teams and you look at leadership, underpinning all of that is emotional intelligence. How we show up, how others experience us, and so on has a huge impact on our success in life, in business, and of course, that leads into happiness and so on and so forth. Now, my guest today is Renan Luttman. Renan is a coach here at Savvy Dentist, and he's an expert when it comes to emotional intelligence. And we're going to be talking all about the facets of emotional intelligence, you know, what makes up emotional intelligence, how to improve emotional intelligence, and where it's applicable directly in the dental setting. It's a long conversation, it's wide-reaching, and of course, we get into the nitty-gritty of lots of different things. We talk about happiness, we talk about positive psychology, we talk about various influences in that space, and I think this is a podcast or an episode that is incredibly relevant at this particular moment in time. It's always relevant, but given the year that we've had in 2020, how people are feeling, how people are reacting to change and to uncertainty, this particular podcast has a rich vein of gold running all the way through it that I know that if you take action on the things that we talk about here, it's going to really set you on a path to greater fulfillment, greater success, and ultimately a happier and, you know, enjoyable life. So I hope you enjoy this a great deal. Now, for those people that are new to the show, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here, of course. And if you happen to be a dental practice owner, please do come and find us at the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. In the Facebook group there, we have tips and tools and trainings there that are going to help you take your practice to the next level of success, whatever that means for you. So again, head across to SavvyDentist.com/Facebook or just search for us in the Facebook search engine and you'll find us there. And if you're a practice owner, we'd love to see you there. But for now, let's get on to our conversation with Renan. As I said, this is a meaty conversation. You're going to want to listen to it a couple of times through, I think. And I really hope you enjoy this because I think this is a message that is absolutely pertinent for this time in our lives. Talk soon. Renan Luttman, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us on the Savvy Dentist podcast. And of course, it's not just welcome to the podcast, it's welcome to the team at Savvy Dentist because you're now one of the family, one of the crew. So welcome on both fronts, mate. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very, very much. Both fronts, very exciting, very timely. What a way to start a continuation of my career at the end of a year.
Yeah.
And the end of a roller coaster year that it's been. But like you say to your client base, how are you going to finish this year?
Yeah.
What are you going to be doing? So I've taken your lead and I'm getting into something very new, very exciting.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And we are going to be talking about EQ, what that is, how it's measured, all those other sorts of things. Before we do get to that, mate, I know you've had tremendous experience coaching dentists in the past. And I wanted to ask you, what have been some of your most interesting observations about working with dentists for such a long period of time, and particularly practice owners? What do you notice about the individuals that are drawn to practice ownership? What do you notice about the sorts of challenges that they face? What do you notice about the sorts of things that they get right, and equally where sometimes they get a little bit, you know, unstuck?
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. I've done hundreds of EQs with practice owners, practice managers, non-owner dentists, hygienists over the last 17 years. I always start off an EQ assessment, like a debrief, after they've done the online inventory with, there is no right or wrong. And it's particularly challenging when you see really low scores or lower than you expected in a certain area. I thought my empathy was way higher than that. Or my assertiveness, I didn't realize I was assertive as this kind of tells me that I am. I usually say, put your two fingers on your wrist, feel your pulse, you're alive and well.
Yeah.
And all we're doing here is exploring something called the emotional world, the hidden world, and how that is working for you or isn't working for you and can be developed. That's the good news. So getting to dentists, as you've mentioned, you're one yourself. I could, you know, for the time that we've known each other, you're a smart, intelligent, motivated individual and man and business owner, as are a lot of other dentists. The IQ to get into dentistry and then to do implantology, et cetera, you need to be able to focus and study and apply. So IQ, high. Interestingly enough, the term IQ was coined, you know, in 1912 by a psychologist called William Stern. So he kind of formalized that. Let's like work out how are people smart. Let's measure that. And that was the inception of IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Again, getting into dentistry, that's required. Fast track that over the last, probably like since the 80s, 90s, Daniel Goleman, which most people may have heard of. Like he was really he was a Harvard student and lecturer in the end. And he did his PhD, which is pretty much his book, which I've got here, number one bestseller, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. So he formalized, he was quite smart. He made palpable for the masses this concept of IQ. What is it? He explained it physiologically and then broke down emotional patterns and different groups and how do we identify where we are on the spectrum and what's working for us and how to change something if we want to change it.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I really like the differentiation you've made between IQ and EQ. And I also like that EQ in particular is not fixed, you know, can be developed, as you've said. And it's interesting, you know, I'm thinking about kids and, you know, obviously you've got kids, I've got kids. And, you know, we all know that there's those kids in life that, you know, may or may not have done well academically at school, the IQ part, but somehow managed to forge a really good path through life. And I'm assuming that's the EQ coming to the surface, coming to the fore there, that allows them to navigate the social situations, the work situations, the career situations that allow them to make progress in life. So I wanted to ask you, you know, is high EQ a predictor for success of some form? Is there a correlation in that space? I'm not sure if there's research around that or not, but is there a correlation between EQ and success in a chosen endeavor?
Yes, there is. And going to Goleman and all the plethora of researchers like around him, that was their number one observation, that IQ in terms of measuring success and pathways was way too narrow. So that was their path of bringing EQ to the fore and exactly what you're saying and highlighting. And we can go through a bit of a case study later on as well around the US Air Force, just as an example, a practical example of, now that we know EQ is the foundation to get into your study and your vocation, in terms of measuring success, though, and how you can manage yourself and your team, if you've got one, and your patient or client base, whatever industry you're in, it start like the chasm starts to widen in terms of why is, if we look at dentists, why is dentist A successful working next door right alongside dentist B? I mean, in really crude terms, it's called bedside manner. In the medical world.
Yep.
But if you were just to reflect now on people that you like and don't like, or you're more attracted to and less attracted to, on analysis, it'd be because they're kind of like this and it doesn't work for me.
It's really interesting because, you know, IQ gets reduced to a number, right? And I know that can be a little bit reductionist. You know, when we reduce everything to a 2 or 3 digit number, you kind of go, well, I'm more than 3 digits or I'm more than 2 digits. I wanted to ask you two things. Firstly, how is EQ measured? But equally, what are the components that make up EQ? You've touched on one or two of them already, empathy, for example. So I wanted to understand what goes into EQ, because we hear that word, and to be candid, some of us might be thinking, well, I think I understand what goes into it, but I don't know that we've really unpacked that. So could you address that first and then talk about how it's measured?
Yes. I realize we haven't even defined it yet. Yeah. So let's do that. So EQ, from a crude definition perspective, is the ability for individuals to recognize their own emotions and those of others and use this information to successfully navigate communication and behavior between whoever you're communicating with.
Mm.
So the key components are self and others.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, like as I said over the years, when I've asked people what their understanding of EQ is, we're going to go on this fun journey dialogue and explore you. Most people say it's about me. And they're right. That's the first part of the definition, is understanding my own internal world.
Mm.
But the key is then, because if you're on an island on your own, your EQ doesn't matter.
No.
No, it matters to your own sanity, but there's no one else to share it with and engage with. So the other key part, component, is and others. And that's where it opens up. So on a practical level, it is measurable, like IQ. The tool that I've been using for the last 17 years is from a company called Multi Health Systems.
Mm-hmm.
It is what is classed as a level B instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of analysis, it's got rigor in terms of scientific rigor, reliability, validity, norms, research and supporting material. So it's not a woman's weekly tick and click.
Yeah.
You know, it's a, so 4,000 people were part of that initial sample,
mm-hmm.
broken up into different age groups and gender.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had 200 men and women in each of the categories of 5 years between when I think it was 18 and 65, if you do the maths. Interestingly enough, they found very little difference between gender.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It, on overall EI scores, emotional intelligence scores. So that's quite fascinating.
Well, that kind of defies a stereotype right there, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it does. So as people, we're pretty much hardwired the same.
Yeah.
There were some subtle differences in some of the different subscales.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprisingly, one of the 15 subscales is empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And intuitively, without, I think being politically correct, women are more in tune with their emotions and able to express them.
Okay. That's really interesting. So I wanted to just touch on those subscales for a moment. So, what are those, just a handful of things that we might be familiar with that we can go, okay, well, we know emotional intelligence is made up of these various, components, empathy being one clearly. What other elements feature in those subscales?
So, there are basic five categories, and they've got three in each. There's a self-perception
mm-hmm.
category, which looks at things like self-regard.
Mm-hmm.
Self-regard comes down to, what do I like about myself? What do I not like about myself? And how does that impact me, though, in terms of how I feel about myself?
Mm.
So for a lot of people, that could be a spiral down.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or for having worked on, having some type of assessment and seeing this is where I am, is the opportunity to spiral up and work on areas that I may want to work on that will benefit me and those around me. Emotional self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
kind of we've touched on that with self-regard. You've got to actually have the ability to identify what is the spread of emotions that are available and start flexing that muscle, as in I am actually feeling A, B, C, or D, angry, excited, elated, frustrated. And then how to actually openly express that is the second category of self-expression.
Mm.
So there's self-perception, how tuned in am I? Then how am I able to give that over to others which is a fascinating category because it involves assertiveness is one of the key areas.
Yeah, that's and I guess, you know, around that self-expression piece, I'm curious to ask, and obviously you'll know this stuff upside down, inside out, but I imagine, does the ability to self-express change based on with whom we're trying to express or the environment within which we're trying to do that? So as an example, is it easier to self-express with your significant other versus a colleague in the workplace, with a team member, with a boss, with a subordinate? Yeah, what are the things that kind of change that?
Jeez, you're... Again, what a great topic. The first thing that comes to mind, probably 90% anecdotally of people that I've had the privilege of working through EQ conversations with say, I'm different at home than I am at work.
Okay.
And when we break that down, though, what comes to light is that, well, I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? They're actually still the same person in the four walls of work or at home.
Yes.
But they have different strategies to deal with the players in each space.
Okay.
So to make that practical, and again, we don't want to fall into gender stereotypes here, but a lot of men running a team of 10, 15, 20 people feel more assertive at work because they have that title, they have their own job description that you know mirrors the title, they have a practice manager, they may have several senior front office coordinators if we're talking about a dental practice, and the license to be assertive seems to be more contained and defined. By the way, we need to define assertiveness. If we were to look on a scale of like 0 to 10, where 5 in the middle is what we would call assertive. And the definition of assertive from an EQ perspective is I've got something to share. It's an opinion, it's a belief, it's a fact.
Yeah.
It's a value. And I want to share that with you, but the way I need to share it to be a 5, to be balanced, is I need to be intact, and you need to be intact after our dialogue.
So it's really, again, I guess that comes in with that self, the intactness for the person who's sharing. That's the self-regard piece, I'm assuming. There's a bit of, you know, influence in that. But again, it's also preserving other people's self-regard in that process as well, and having that conversation in such a way that no one is left diminished. And indeed, hopefully there's a greater understanding that's been achieved as a result of that communication.
Yes. Yes. So much so. And if we go to the each extreme where a 0 is what we would call passive aggressive, and a 10 is the stereotypical screaming, angry, do it my way.
Yep.
My way, the highway type thing, like very dominant. So neither work.
No.
And the thing I love about assertiveness as well, like if you're really in the zone and you've got something to share as we've defined it, if the person I'm speaking to has something better to offer, I'm going to run with that.
Yeah.
So that's where it really opens up in terms of leverage.
So that's a really interesting topic because I was talking to a client today and we're talking about leadership in business. And as I just mentioned to you prior to us starting this conversation, the comment that came from this particular practice owner is sometimes leadership can feel lonely, and sometimes there's that stereotypical vision of leaders that, you know, it's a leader-follower type of thing. I'm the leader, I've got all the answers, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm hearing you say is that as a leader, it's not necessary to have all the answers all the time. It's about being able to ask good questions. And as you say, if you can approach that conversation with good self-regard, leave the other person intact as well, it's likely that you'll find some great answers coming back to you, or great views or insights that are going to enhance the business. And therefore, your role as the leader is about engaging and facilitating much more than knowing and telling. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. Yes. And a practical example of this could be in a team meeting.
Yeah.
Where if it's traditionally run by the business owner and they're the talking head, they've made the agenda, and it's literally like their own running list, and everyone has to scramble to find their way into that list.
Mm-hmm.
You're unlikely as that the owner of that business to generate and promote idea from the team. Because like we're talking a crude analysis here, like it's a bit old school, but we can all relate to it. Whereas if we're going in fresh, it's almost like we're equals. I need to encourage my team to populate a team meeting agenda. The interesting thing as well, though, in being part of a team is that as the team member, I need to be flexing. Like we're all individuals here. I need to be aware of my own emotional landscape in that I can't be overly disappointed if everything I put forward doesn't get taken up by the business.
Of course, yes.
Which is why we shine a light on this, and we literally skills practice, what is good dialogue? What does it look like? How do you present an idea? How do you receive one? How do you reach consensus? And how do we say, that's a great idea, but we're going to park it? Or that's a great idea, but we're not going to run with it. And everyone to feel like, what a great place to work at. That's the goal here. That's a whole conversation and discussion with the team. Like, can you contribute? How do you contribute? Do you want to contribute more? Is it well received? You know, in a previous life, talking about team meetings, there's something called the plonk, which means I'm coming up, or the kill. So I've had the courage to share something in front of my 20 colleagues.
Yep.
And it gets like, that's ridiculous. That's not going to work. It's the kill.
I love that. And it's really interesting. I was listening to someone talk about, you know, what is a team? You know, what is a team? And it's a group of people pursuing, you know, common objective, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a fairly standard definition. But one of the things that came up in this conversation was the role of the leader. And, you know, part of being in a team was this, you know, vulnerability, being able to share something. And you've just touched on a really important point, and that is if we are taking the point of view that the team have got a lot of great answers and they're a wonderful resource that we can tap into, then if we're asking them to be vulnerable, and of course we first need to lead with our own vulnerability, but if we go in for that kill, as you say, and cut that down, it just is totally counterproductive, because it then means that people zip their lips, they sit quietly, they might have some wonderful things that they could share, but they don't because they're worried about that kill that you've just spoken about.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Absolutely. And an unfortunate byproduct of that over time is when those people shut down, the business owner then turns around in X amount of time and says, you're not contributing. So it's, you know, so often that's a good starting point for an open and frank conversation as to, can I share why I'm not contributing? And this could come, you know, typically in the form of like some type of motivation and satisfaction check-in or a performance review, where if it's set up well, it's like, I don't feel comfortable. We can go down that road. And often it's the business owner that, you know, that has been hijacked by their own emotions in different areas of life and business is 99% of the time unaware. You know, and that's where EQ 360 comes in.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
you can see what's coming back and forward and understand that holistic view. I guess, you know, to come back to the point of how EQ is measured, because we spoke about those subscales and presuming there's some sort of scoring system around that. Can you just talk about the measurement of EQ? Because again, sometimes what I find with emotional type of things, it feels very qualitative in my mind sometimes rather than quantitative. So how do we take that qualitative feeling and get some quantitative data from that that's going to allow us to then know where to spend time and energy in terms of our own development and development of our team.
Yeah, great. So, look, that's, I guess, the beauty of a report. I've actually got one in front of me. What happens when 100 is like the healthy average?
Yep.
On this score. So any standard deviations, the report literally spits out if you're in a low, a mid, or a high range.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually do, and so that's for a standard workplace report. There's actually a specific leadership report
mm-hmm.
that benchmarks you according to leaders with high EQ. So mm-hmm. it actually shows you where you are on the scale of what good looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular report, and I'm assuming others as well, you know, when you move from a low to a high range, like similar to when I say to people, put your fingers on your pulse, you're alive and well, and you made it to today. I also say whoever does these types of inventories, everyone is moving from low to high.
Yeah.
So where you are is your starting point. There is no right and wrong. By the way, 99% of people that I've done this with have said at the onset, this is me.
Mm.
Wow. Like, how did they do this? Like, actually, this is me. And then they talk about what's important. They often drive the conversation.
Sure.
And for people that have quite a high EQ, they get that I can tweak this area.
Mm-hmm.
I can tweak this area. Mm-hmm. And if we take EQ to a deeper level, the subscales have relationships with each other.
Mm-hmm. So okay.
Impulse control, assertiveness, self-regard. You know, it's tough to fudge this inventory, but, you know, to make something practical, I may be overly independent because my independence is lower than my assertiveness, which means I'm just going to do it my way.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just going to do it my way because my assertiveness muscles may not need improving. So there's a choice point where I could say to this part of the team or this particular person, hey, can we talk about topic A?
Mm-hmm.
This is the project. We get agreement, like in an assertive way. I'm okay, you're okay, and we've got a good outcome and this person knows how to proceed with all the follow-up and expectation required in this project, let's say. A leader or a person, it could be any person, like this is not role specific, it's like people specific. Someone may say, you know what, I'm just going to do that myself.
Mm.
So in the guise of being independent, really what's being sacrificed is assertiveness.
Mm.
So we could, does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. So there's always something. The numbers are just a starting point. It's really the conversation that comes up.
Yeah.
I tell you one that really rocks the boat for a lot of people, and I've seen it enough to confidently say, is empathy.
Okay. I would expect most dentists to score pretty well on empathy, but I think you're going to surprise me on that.
Yes. And look, this could probably go back to the persona at work and home.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, getting back to IQ, that gets you into the course and into the training.
Yeah.
And as you will be very familiar with, you want your dentist to be good at finding problem and fixing it.
Yep.
So, you know, that's ticket to play for patient and clinician. But when you... When that spill, and you're doing that 8 hours a day with your loops on, so you're very targeted mm-hmm. in finding problem, finding problem, finding problem, finding problem, fixing it, problem, fix, problem, fix. So when that spills out into not being conscious enough mm-hmm. that the mouth I'm working on is attached to a head, which mm-hmm. has a neck and there's a body in my chair. This person has a name.
Yeah, and feelings.
So, you know, the typical response, stereotypical response of a dentist that speaks to a new patient and the patient has the courage to say, I hate coming here. It's not an easy thing to say to someone you've just met who's going to be fixing you and sticking sharp instruments into your mouth. They actually hate being here.
Yeah.
You don't usually kick off a relationship like
that.
No. They're sharing it for a reason. They need to purge either a previous dental experience or a current fear or a merging of the two.
And I think every single dentist who's practiced for more than half an hour has had the no offense, doc, but I hate being here thrown at them. And I guess the thing around that is after a while, it takes a lot of resilience to receive that as well, because there, I put my hand up here, there have been times when, you know, quietly I might have rolled my eyes subconsciously, hopefully not visibly in that response. And, you know, I feel guilty as I'm saying that out loud. But I guess to hear that and to take it on board and to not react to it in the way that I have done in the past, certainly, or to come back with a smart aleck remark of, it's all right, I hate being here too, or, you know, something, you know, kind of some sort of joke to diffuse it rather than engaging with them with what's important to them, that requires a bit of self-awareness as well, right?
Yes. And that's the knee-jerk empathy reaction. Best practice would be, so sorry, that's been your experience. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, engage with it. So lean into it.
Correct.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, so there's empathy, not, and it's all, we should preface all this as well. Everyone is behaving and acting in order to be right.
Yes.
Not wrong. So no one wakes up of a morning, unless you're like a psychopath, like, how can I ruin my first patient's day?
Yeah.
You know, but we do this as humor, and that has its place.
And I think it's also reasonable to be kind to yourself, because no one gets this right all the time, right? No one's Mother Teresa. No one's got everything, you know, perfect every moment of the day. We all have our lapses where we're kind of good and less good at this, correct?
Yes. Which comes to, that's that self-regard, like, and ideally, like, I would have hundreds of dentists with their nurses giving feedback.
Yeah.
So this week, you've got my full permission to please bring to my attention just this very example. When someone shares a pain point, they're sharing emotion and what's gone on, a previous dentist, I'm getting a tooth pulled out. I personally can tell you, Jesse, I can still feel, and it's hilarious, but it happened to me. I can still feel Dr. X's knee on my chest and the pop or the crack of a wisdom tooth being pulled out.
Mm.
It happened.
It's a real experience, yeah.
Put the fear of, you know, like, that is like, it's a highly unusual way to be supporting someone. Doesn't happen, you know, anywhere else in any industry.
No.
To be able to get feedback from a team member, to be able to say, when patient X, you know, said why they were petrified, .. you went down the route of, don't worry, we'll try and hurt you half as much.
Yeah, you went down the human route or whatever it was, yeah.
That's right. And you know, and when you get trained up in this, to be able to just say and flex that muscle, I'm so sorry, that's been your experience. Can you tell me a bit about that? And they'll tell you, he was on my chest and I heard it pop. The science, by the way, behind just letting the person purge that,
it's huge.
Not only builds trust and relationship, but this is the real hidden value, is that they are likely to be more open and attentive to what it is you're about to share with them. Let's imagine this is a new patient.
Mm.
And for the first 5 or 10 minutes, you've spoken about Fluffy the cat, where they've worked, you know, what you've got in common, but you've uncovered any emotional and experiential concerns, because for the next, let's say a new patient exam is for an hour, for the next 50 minutes, you're going to be sharing with them what the disease and breakdown in their mouth.
Mm.
It could be $40,000 worth of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't in a way prepared and had an open mind, and they were just worried about, when's the knee coming on the chest, so to speak?
They're closed.
They're closed.
Yeah. I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, Renan, because I think there's something in this. But before I do, the magic that I think you've just shared there, apart from, you know, lots of it, but the thing is giving yourself that little microsecond to respond rather than to impulsively react. And you mentioned earlier impulse control is important, or a component of EQ.
Yes.
And so I guess it's about being aware of that reflex response. And yeah, obviously there's a reason why people use that, you know, I'm only going to hurt you half as much kind of reflex response. That's serving in some way, right? Because otherwise you wouldn't say it. But I guess it's about giving yourself that millisecond or microsecond to be able to say, don't just play the same record over, listen and engage differently. So before I go back into our conversation earlier and ask you something else, I want to ask you about that millisecond. How to break that, how to resist the impulse to respond as you may have done for a long time.
It's a great, that is the fourth subset. So there's self-perception, self-expression, there's interpersonal relationships, which includes empathy.
Yep.
The fourth one is decision-making, which is problem-solving, reality testing, and impulse control.
Mm.
So that's the one we'll focus on. You're just reminding me of the amount of times I've heard enough honest people, dentists here, say that they've thrown an instrument.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, you know, a handful, but I mean, have I heard it? Absolutely. Why? Because it was the wrong one.
Mm.
So that is low impulse control. We would all agree.
Mm, mm, mm.
So there would be two paths to get to the millisecond. We need to prep for that millisecond.
Mm.
So the first thing would be, like, on analysis, why does that happen? It's because the instruments were not set up on the tray right
yep.
for a particular treatment. You can relate to that.
Sure.
Is that a training issue? Is that something that keeps repeating for that particular individual?
Mm.
That'd be one avenue. The second avenue is, and I'm thinking about a couple of clients I've had over the years, is let's look at your revolving door of staff.
Mm.
Have you explored that? What's your understanding of that? And look, we may, for the point of our conversation here, it eventually comes to, this is one of the reasons people leave, because I'm a bit hot-headed. Okay, good. So what I'm getting at here is part of the incentive to be able to work in the split second is I need to be aware not only of what I'm feeling at the time, but the consequences.
Absolutely. And so, that then goes back to the self-regard, because if you're reacting impulsively, it erodes self-regard, I presume, in some cases, if you're throwing the instrument. Or again, there's many other instances of impulse control going awry. It erodes self-regard, right?
Yeah. And in... Look, there's also feedback after these events to diffuse and understand. There's lots of modalities that actually talk about, like, this moment as well. Taking a breath.
Yeah.
Taking a breath, which is what I was listening to one of your podcasts yesterday of one of your guest speakers of, you know, the recent conference,
David Fries.
David Fries, who had the great advice of breathing, the 4-4 technique, breathe in for four, hold for four, breathe out for four, hold for four, which is what the Marines use in highly stressful situations to gain composure. So breathing techniques is a whole rabbit hole, but, you know, most people will just be aware that in these moments of high tension, they're not even aware of their breath, and they're probably breathing more shallow than usual.
I really love the decision-making thing and the impulse control, because I think one of the expressions I like to use is that when emotions are high, intelligence is low.
Yes.
And we can, in an emotional state, make a decision that we later regret, of course, when things have settled down, and then we've got to live with the aftermath of that. So I think there's something in that. But there's a lot in that. But I wanted to just go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is, as dentists, we're trained to find fault and to fix it. And what I wanted to address specifically was there are some elements in a role or in a component of life that can be a strength and desirable. But if you take that same trait into another element of your life, it's less desirable. So just to take this find it and fix it kind of thing, as dentists, we tend to be trained to find fault. That's our training. That's what we do. We look at a variety of different diagnostic tools in order to find those faults so that we can then help that person by fixing it. Now, what that can mean for some of us is that we become quite, you know, perfectionistic. It means that we can find fault in other people very quickly. We obviously find fault in ourselves very quickly, but it means that fault-finding thing can go to a degree that is not helpful. So I wanted to ask you is how do we take that apparent strength in a particular area or role of our life and not let it become a negative in another area of our life? How do we, you know, put a bit of a boundary around that?
That's a great word, the boundary. That's what I was thinking of. First of all, I'd start by saying there needs to be an acknowledgement and an awareness that this is a preferred way of being. So, because if we don't have that awareness, then we can't, you know, we usually shine a light on something, understand it before we look at changing it. That's why we look at KPIs. You know, around a practice, we want to change something. Let's not be so quick. Let's see what the figures tell us, and then we can make an informed decision. So I think like one of the answers as well is that on analysis of life, we can, if we were to ask the question as a clinician, have you got this awareness of looking at problem? Yes, and that's a positive thing. Absolutely, in that arena. Question, does that spill over into other areas of your life? Or how does that spill over? How does that play out in other areas of your life? Opens up a conversation to how I am with my friends, my team, my partner, my children. And what does that practically mean? And this is EQ. This is understanding self, remember, and others. For a kid that comes home, you know, my 15-year-old son said last week, I got 93 in the maths tests. There's a part of me.
Is what happened to the other seven?
That's right. What happened to the other seven? What happened to the other? And by the way, that's if you're a person that is inclined for the initial knee-jerk responses, what happened to the other seven? Everyone would agree that that's coming from a good place. What do you really mean by that? It means I think you're so capable. This is the warped version. I think you're so capable that what happened to the other seven? Like, what, this is a compliment. This is a backhanded compliment.
Yeah. Emphasis on backhanded.
That's right. So for the first two steps are, is this me? Where does it work? And then how do I open up the conversation? Where does it not work? And this is typically what we do in an EQ conversation. And then most people are inspired and motivated then to get into action around how can I be more generous? How can I show more gratitude? How can I be more positive? Most people with that persona, by the way, are more glass half empty people, just parenthetically. Because if your glass is half empty, then that's the way you'll respond to other people's glasses.
Yeah. So that ties into, I remember some of the work with Martin Seligman around learned optimism and, you know, what that looks like. And so I'm curious to ask you, where does optimism fit in the EQ spectrum of things? And can optimism actually be improved? Can you go from a glass half empty to someone who's seeing the glass a bit fuller than they might have done in the past?
Yes, absolutely. And what a great segue. This particular EQ report has at the very end of it something called a well-being indicator.
Yeah.
So we've gone through self-perception, self-expression, interpersonal decision-making. And by the way, the last one is stress management, which includes flexibility, stress tolerance, and optimism. And by the way, when we talk about all of these items, these subscales, flexibility is we have to remember this is through the emotional lens. So flexibility doesn't mean being a doormat. Who's taking out the garbage today in the practice and who's cleaning the toilet? That's always left to me. I'm very flexible. No, that's not the assertiveness would be lacking there.
Yep.
Hey, let's get some type of a roster. I'm not sure why I need to be doing all of those jobs.
Yeah, totally.
Come and share it around, etc. Flexibility here is adapting emotions and thoughts and behaviors to what is unfamiliar, unpredictable,
mm-hmm.
the dynamic circumstance. So COVID, for example, has really demanded, like it's forced upon us to flex these emotional muscles in terms of like working from home. That's a whole different conversation, but flexibility you would have seen in or have heard maybe in your own team or people that you're coaching and working with, that team member that with JobKeeper and all the rest of, remember those conversations? It was just like, no, the law is I can stay at home and get paid, and that's what I'm doing. There was a block mm-hmm. to being practically flexible and emotionally flexible. There was too much rigidity there.
Yeah.
So optimism. So the well-being indicator takes four of these subscales
mm-hmm.
and is working with the premises that happiness includes feeling of satisfaction and contentment and the ability to enjoy life. It says that happiness both contributes to and is a byproduct of emotional intelligence. So it's kind of like the glue.
Mm.
It's this all elusive thing, like there's books on being happier, etc. But it's actually, I love this being like you bring it and you also take it, but there's no box called happiness.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think, every single parent that I'm aware of, at least, has said something to the, a version of, what do you hope for their kids? You want them to be happy, right? You want your kids to have a happy life.
Yes.
Very rarely do you hear a parent turn around and say, I want them to go on and achieve a career in X industry, rise to the top of it, whatever it is, right? So what I'm trying to understand then is, what is happiness? At a very core foundation, you've said that, the EQ is certainly the foundation of that, but happiness is something that I feel that is sometimes hard to describe. And also, I wonder, what's the difference between happiness and joy? Because and can happiness be sustained, or is it a fleeting thing? And I know we're kind of getting a little bit off the beaten track here, into some deep water, but I'm keen to have a swim if you are.
I tell you what, I've got in front of me, I've got a couple of my favorite books. One of them is by, again, Harvard University trained and lecturing a guy called Tal Ben-Shahar with Martin Seligman that you've mentioned, at the forefront of the positive psychology movement.
Yeah.
I've got his book here, The Pursuit of Perfect.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a great read. And in the intro, and by the way, he's got another book called Happier. And at Harvard, he runs a course on happiness. So he's really put himself out there as a target. And the reason I'm saying is that he, in the introduction to this book, he bumps a guy on the university campus and says, hey, you're Tal Ben-Shahar, the lecturer of how to be happy.
Yep.
My mate is doing your course. So if I ever see you unhappy, I'm going to be telling him. So the reason he puts this in his introduction is to highlight the very reason that if we need to get clear about what happiness is.
Yeah.
Because if it's walking around with a big smile on your face.
Yeah, whistling Dixie all day.
That's right. Then you're going to be sorely disappointed from Monday to Tuesday.
Yeah.
That's not what it is.
No.
But that was that, young man's. And he wasn't joking.
No,
I think he explored the conversation with him. He was like, this is legit. Like, if you say this is who you are, you better be like walking it full time. So to be getting, and I'm not, are you familiar with Russell Harris as well?
Yeah, Happiness Trap and so on. Yeah.
Happiness Trap. So like that. So his whole exploration of the ACT therapy, just in the breakdown, acceptance and commitment therapy means there are things that you're going to have to be accepting and committing to accepting that, that is going to be your pathway to happiness. If we explore him for another 30 seconds, I think one of the nuggets, the gold nuggets of that book is he's working with thought. So by the way, in terms of self-regard and in terms of lifting how you see yourself, his book and his online material is, and his courses and his lecturing is around strategies of minimizing the self, identifying the self-talk. Like he describes it as thoughts are waves coming into the shore.
Yep. Come and they go.
If they're doozies, let them crash. Like you can't fight the tide. By the way, you could spend 50 years fighting the tide.
Yes. I think I spent a good 35 doing that, actually. Somewhere between 30 and 35. I was fighting the good fight there for a while, but you had to surrender to the tide.
Yeah. Let the ones that are not worthy come into the shore. You've got to identify what's not worthy, though. But the ones, in a way, the emotions and the thoughts, that may be a bit painful, maybe a bit surprising, but if you can ride them, you can, like, they're there for you to benefit from. So a practical example of that would be, I've got to speak in front of a group of people and I'm not well-versed in that.
Yep.
I'm horrified. I'm up all night. I've got the self-talk that I'm going to fail. It's just not, I'm going to forget everything. It's going to be miserable. The analysis with an emotionally intelligent person at that point in time would be, let's look at that wave called I'm going to crash and burn and it's going to be a disaster. What's the evidence for that? He goes through the whole technique. Yeah. What's the evidence, et cetera, et cetera. On analysis, there's not. I'll let it go through and have a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
If on analysis I'm speaking in front of 50 people and I'm nervous, et cetera, and on analysis I haven't prepared for it, I don't really know the topic, that could be the inspiration to learn more about the topic or do some public speaking. So that's riding a wave to benefit yourself. So his whole thing around that is that's one of his things. I just want to go back to the wellbeing indicator. The four subscales are self-regard. It's kind of nice to tie all this up now.
Yeah.
Optimism.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep. Interpersonal relationships and self-actualization.
Okay. So good old Maslow gets a run in there, does he?
He does. He does. You know, like, am I living a purposeful, meaningful existence? That's one quarter of the pie.
Okay.
Interpersonal relationships, by the way, and this is where we have been hammered, especially fellow Victorians, for the last 9 months that we're coming out of COVID. The shift that has been required into interpersonal relationships, just to define that, is kind of symbiotic. It's like, how do I connect with people and how do I let them connect with me?
Yes.
By the way, just parenthetically, this is a great practical exploration for a lot of dentists at the practice. When we're talking about problem solving and loops on and head down, if interpersonal relationships are low, that is the great opportunity. And I love in these conversations where people just say, hey, do you reckon I should have lunch with the team? That's a light bulb moment. Or I did that 5 years ago and it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, from that, I've got I've worked with a practice that has the principal dentist. He's an outlier. He built a gourmet kitchen.
Yeah, nice.
And the team from 1 till 2, they have got a rotation on who's shopping for whatever's done and who's on cooking, and they cook for the team.
That's great.
Yeah, that's like, he's the only person I've had to do that. Other people have variations on that theme. You know, at least they have a tea room or a team room and have lunch, and the principal dentist, wow, he or she is going to sit down for half an hour. That's and eat lunch with the team.
That just puts our barbecue and courtyard to shame. I'm thinking I've got to up my gourmet game now. The bangers and mash is not going to cut it.
That is fantastic if that's what you're doing.
Snags and bread, mate, is probably.
Yeah, no, that's – look, it's – you know, there's a whole lot that goes on there. There's reciprocity that comes back, which you're not looking for, but it's
there.
You know, just downtime, connecting. I've had clients over the years that would take it a step further and try and formalize the informal connection, this interpersonal relationship. They've got a rotation. If there's 20 people in the team, I'm going out for a coffee fortnight for 20 minutes. It says tea with Bob. It's pre-blocked.
Yeah.
And we're going out of the practice. We're going to go to the local coffee shop and we're going to have a cuppa together or a coffee, whatever you want. And it's, you know, it really takes the investment in the time and why are we doing this? What are the benefits? What's the return on investment?
It's huge.
To get that to a pre-block stage and get it happening.
It's interesting when we talk about meaning and purpose, because that was one of the things on your well-being indicator. I just want to touch on that in a second, but I have an intellectual crush. So I just want to emphasize the word intellectual crush on Brené Brown. I'm a big fan of the work that she does. I've enjoyed her TED Talks and Netflix doco. And one of her famous sayings is that connection is what gives meaning and purpose to our life.
Yes.
And so I want to touch on the topic of purpose And I want to understand what you mean by purpose, because I think it sometimes gets caught up with the whole start with why Simon Sinek thing. And I want to understand what purpose is and why it's different to start with why. I've done a bit of thinking on the start with why recently and I've changed my opinion on it, but I'd love to hear your views on purpose and then the start with why thing.
By the way, as well, like if you haven't listened to Simon Sinek's appraisal of empathy on YouTube.
Okay, all right. I'll do
14 that. Minutes.
Yeah.
Probably the best definition of empathy.
Yeah, okay.
So purpose, self-actualization. The research around that really highlights that it comes from a deep willingness. It's not the end goal that I'm sitting on, you know, on the couch or the deck chair and, you know, like I'm living a purposeful life. That may be a result or maybe a fun byproduct. But here it's really talking about, am I living a life that is in line with my values?
Yes.
And like it may be a deeper purpose as well. And what is my capacity to keep challenging where I'm at? What is the willingness to grow and develop?
Yeah.
That's really part of self-actualization. Is not five bedrooms and paycheck.
No, it's not. It's not the big house and the Ferrari and the, you know, the bikini-clad wife. You know, that's not it.
Yeah, it's developing feelings of achievement connected to purpose and value. So, in order to do that, you have to kind of get clear with, well, what do I value? Kind of, what's my own purposeful mission? And by the way, I'm just going to really bring this down to the treatment room for a nurse.
Yeah.
For a nurse that's 20, is she or he self-actualized? Not to a full life's development, but I'd be really encouraging them, you know, it's not just sucking spit is the expression.
First of all,
I'd be looking at, does any nurse have expanded duties? What else can they be doing besides
that? Yes, to grow and develop.
Exactly. That's a whole conversation in itself. But to for them to realize they're part of a group that they may love, ideally, the team, whose mission statement is to be the best in that city.
Yep.
So all of a sudden now I see my role from 9 to 5, 5 days a week, of being part of a great team that provides excellence in dentistry and looking after the oral health of the community. That's what I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting. I love that, and I absolutely resonate with that. Years ago, I became very fascinated with the whole start with why thing of Simon Sinek, and I was a real big champion of that movement, and because at the time it resonated with me. And I wanted to get, yeah, and I'm going to probably sound like a heretic in a moment, because I also really like Viktor Frankl's work as well, yeah, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes, yes.
I think that's a really wonderful book. And again, if anyone hasn't read that, please do yourself a favor. Yes. And as Molly Meldrum would say, do yourself a favor and grab a coffee. If you're old enough to know who Molly Meldrum is, great. If you're too young for that, I'm with you. Yeah, just get the book, right, is the message, right? But the point I'm trying to make in all that is, you know, when Simon Sinek spoke about his golden circles, you know, with why in the middle and then the what and the how and so on and so forth, yeah, you know, and he gave Apple as an example, it sounded incredibly profound. You know, we're here to change the world, basically, and the way we're going to do it is with our computers and technology and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, at the time, I really resonated with that because I was looking for some direction in my life and so on and so forth. But I've come to see it a little bit differently, and maybe my views will change again. Who knows? And maybe it's just a snapshot of where I am. But I was having a conversation with someone the other day who was stuck, and he was stuck because he couldn't find the internal drive to keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. And he was referencing, you know, where's my why? Why is this important to me? You know, what's going to get me out to continue to grow and to develop and to push and da 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 da. And he was looking for this, you know, parting of the clouds moment where the sun would shine through and there'd be an epiphany of sorts, and he'd have his why. And I guess I don't know if that's exactly what Simon Sinek had intended with Start With Why, but I think that might be an unintended consequence that people are looking for some profound inspiration or epiphany. Whereas I think what Viktor Frankl spoke about is there's meaning in the work. And, yes. And what I shared with this particular client is do the work and the meaning will follow. And I wanted to ask your view about how to reconcile those two perspectives and where does that leave us with EQ? Sorry, that's a curveball. Sorry, that's a big question.
You know, like, honestly, the first thing that has come to mind is when we talk about EQ in the whole COVID period.
Yeah.
And coming out of that, everyone's, you know, been in the same storm in a different boat. I love that expression. Like, what's your experience of it?
Yeah.
But like, I don't know the individual you're referring to, but a lack of motivation.
Yeah.
Like now has been so common.
Mm.
And it's something to be mindful of, like moving forward.
Mm.
Because it's not so easy just to flop out of this experience.
Yeah.
If you speak to any psychologist around town, they're booked out till March next year. And that, you know, you don't have to be good to be booked out now, you know.
Mm.
It's like the need is ramped up. So ironically, we're talking about happiness here and motivation. Self-regard and optimism for a lot of people have taken a dive.
Yeah.
Self-regard, you know, like lost my job.
Mm.
Got to work from home now, tech savvy, not, how do I managing, you know, the whole experience has left a lot of people needing to rebuild themselves and get back to, I mean, the opportunity is to go further now, not just back to, because like for those that see it, This has been a period where there's been opportunity forced upon for self-reflection.
Yeah. So lots of big topics, Renan. We could probably speak for 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours.
I don't even know if that answered your question. Like we're, you know, we've moved.
I guess I'm trying to reconcile how I am interpreting Simon Sinek's work with Viktor Frankl's work, and I see them as two views of a similar thing, and maybe both are right. And I'm trying to understand, you know, at various moments in time, what's going to be the lens through which you look to determine that. And I guess, you know, I'm a big admirer of Simon Sinek and the work that he does, but I on a personal level, I've been looking at that recently and going, it seems to me to infer or imply there's got to be a big earth-shattering, life meaning change the world kind of mission before people get started. And I guess in the context of trying to help this person with their motivation, and I agree with you, by the way, I think COVID has knocked the wind out of a lot of sails.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the point I was trying to make is Viktor Frankl might just say, just get started and find the meaning in the work itself rather than looking for this external thing. And I'm just trying to understand that what I'm perceiving is a dichotomy, and maybe it's not a dichotomy.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you look at Viktor Frankl, like, if we're talking about, like, asking the question, who am I and what is my motivation?
Yeah.
His answer to that was, a decent citizen of the world, and my motivation is to live.
Yeah, yes.
My motivation is to live. But remember, his whole logotherapy is strategies for surviving.
Certainly the context was
correct.
Yeah, very unique and different.
But it was like, but really to break it down, it was like those that had a personal mission, that's what got them through.
Mm.
So, you know, and I'm sure if we were to dovetail EQ into that, there's always the practical strategy of Synex circles, etc., that you've mentioned. But then there always needs to be, and this is where EQ is coming to the fore again. It's there's always a practical lens and then an emotional lens.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually usually start my EQ calls as well with what we're exploring is as real as the physical world.
Absolutely.
So like when you put your fingers, you know, to go full circle here, when you put your finger on your pulse and you got up and had brekkie before this call and, you know, what's this call going to be? It's just going to be a conversation. Looking at the more, I had bookmarked a great quote. It is with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye.
Ooh.
Yeah. So what we're talking about in EQ is as real as the table and the chair, and it's real on an invisible level. So, and I feel that us Western men and women, like depending on your family of origin, we can get fancy with all those like words. We're in the process of becoming better in identifying these realities. Your guest speaker, the CIA agent.
Yeah, Dave.
What's his book about? Or one of his books? I mean, I've only met him through you recently. I've got an hour and a half experience of him. It's how to communicate with kids. So he's distilled this emotional world into something like practical. And what better people to work with than the next generation of flexing the muscle of emotional awareness.
I really, really like that. And sorry, I'm going off on a small tangent here, but I just need to share with you. And ladies and gents, just indulge me for a moment. A little while ago, I was given a book called My Super Me, Finding the Courage for Tough Stuff. It's a kid's book. I'm holding it up to the screen and I can see it's got a yellow cover. And the authors are Todd Herman and Evie Jones. And the message in there was so good. It's obviously written for a younger audience, but the message was so good. I read it to our boardroom clients, and I can assure you there's a couple of moist eyes on that call. And I think that there's something about being able to see that through the eyes of a child, because I think the message that we intuitively want to give our children is obviously sometimes the message we need to hear ourselves.
Oh, 100%. I, by the way, throughout COVID with my wife, you know, we've got four kids and one on the way. We did two emotional coaching parenting courses, tuning into teens and tuning into kids.
Yeah.
And it was emotion coaching for a kid. And the take home, by the way, from that is, what is your relationship as an adult to the gamut of emotions?
Mm-hmm.
You got to get that right first.
Yeah.
You got to look at you. It's very confronting.
Yeah.
If you're dealing with teenagers that are expressing, right, you know, fear, anger, disappointment, etc. If your relationship to fear and anger is stonewall,
yeah,
then you're going to come out with, like, it's the mathematical equation. You're going to come out with, don't be so stupid, don't be afraid of that, don't be a sook, blah blah blah, which is just polarizing.
Yeah, it's
so
helpful.
Doesn't it? It causes more damage and more anger than moving towards each other. We move away.
Yeah.
So this is the work that we are doing now as humankind. You know, EQ wasn't around 50 years ago.
No.
Now it's bestsellers and there are courses, and the conversation now is becoming normal.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
Thank goodness. Renan, we have covered a lot of territory today. We've gone uphill and down dale, traversed over all sorts of different topics. We've touched on what EQ is, how to measure it, what makes it up. We've spoken about well-being indices, you know, optimism, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that I really appreciate about you, there's lots of things I appreciate about you. One of the things I really appreciate is not just your depth of knowledge, your understanding of the topic. I mean, that's clearly apparent. But I really appreciate your considered approach to things, the fact that you're able to really have that pause to be able to reflect, to be able to respond rather than react, and to be able to listen and to guide people through that. It's a wonderful attribute.
Thank you.
I really mean it. It's a wonderful thing. I'm super excited about introducing this to the people we work with. I think there's an incredible volume of work that can be done to improve the relationships of, yeah, you know, the people we work with in their workplace, in their homes, to develop their leadership, to help them develop other leaders within the team. And of course, that all has not just personal benefits of clearly it's going to help fulfillment and satisfaction and so on, but it's also going to have a tangible commercial payoff as well. And I'm going to encourage everyone who's listening just to think about, you know, to understand, well, here's my premise is that for your business to grow, first we must grow. And I think this is a really useful tool to be that leading indicator for that. So if we can grow ourselves, then the business will follow.
Absolutely, absolutely. And maybe it's a conversation for another time. We hadn't had the chance to look at any case studies, but this actual inventory that, you know, I've been using has been used by the US Air Force, by Amex, Fortune 500 companies, and they all say, bar none, shining a light on the development of EQ brings return on investment in terms of retention, recruiting, and dollars and productivity.
Yeah.
And
I think interestingly enough, we all say that our people are our biggest asset.
Yes.
Maybe it's time that we live that. So just a thought.
Well, it's a thought, and I'm looking forward to making that a reality, having joined you, because that's what I want to bring to the client base as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, mate. Renan, once again, mate, from all of us here and on behalf of the listeners as well, thank you so much for your generosity of spirit, the generosity in sharing your knowledge, your wisdom and your insights, and of course, taking the time to give of yourself today. I'm really, really appreciative, mate.
Thank you very, very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Cheers, really, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.